This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal. After that introduction, which I played of my interview with Richie Allen from Monday, which began discussing false flags, but then when I reached the point of talking about 7-7 and mentioned Kullerstrom and Farrell Are Dead, which is a new documentary that Nick Kullerstrom, who's the author of Terror on the Tube, now in its third edition, had made with Tony Farrell, who was, of course, an intelligence analyst for one of the police departments there in London. He immediately started raising questions about Nick's research on the Holocaust, which I explained, of course, is scientific research about the possible use of Zyklon B in the gas chambers. So to follow that up, I thought it would be very appropriate to bring Nick on to talk about it. So we have the three segments here after having heard the first, devoted to the interview with Richie Allen, for us to converse. And I have not only Nick here, but also Kevin Barrett, who has a keen interest in a wide range of issues. And I thought it would be very good to get his contributions too. Nick, welcome to The Real Deal.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, Jim, especially with Kevin.
Yeah, and Kevin, welcome. Welcome, my friend.
Yeah, good to be with both of you.
Well, it's just terrific. It's just terrific. We haven't seen each other together since Vancouver, though you and I, Kevin, of course, last night, actually, had the pleasure of having dinner together in town. Nick, why don't we begin by you know, just some general responses. I know you feel very strongly about the Holocaust as having been a major form of deception of not just the American people, but even the world's population.
Yeah, well, what I thought was a science issue, it turns out to be some sort of new religion. I mean, I was interested in investigating several different chemical surveys that people had taken, chipped out from the walls of Auschwitz and Birkenau, bits of old remains from 60 years ago, and then measured the iron cyanide in it. And I thought it was fascinating the way this gives you a memory of how the cyanide gas was used in the World War II labor camps, because loads of many tons of Zyklon were used. Everyone agrees on that, but of Zyklon. And the question is, were they used in delousing chambers for killing bugs, or were they used in monster human chambers for killing Jews? And is this a subject we can discuss or not? Or not, okay? And back in 2008, I discovered that it definitely was not a subject we could discuss, and I was guilty of heresy. I'd violated what was sacred, and I was to be cast out from polite society. And suddenly half my friends weren't talking to me anymore, and I was getting vilified by everyone and chucked out of my college. Let me make clear, Jim, I majored in history and philosophy of science precisely because I believe that we should be able to look at the evidence of how technology was used in the past. Now, this is a question of delousing chambers, which ostensibly had the Zyklon insecticide supplied once the typhus epidemics broke out in the year 1942. They were constructed throughout all the labor camps. And was this how the Zyklon was used? And why is nobody in any British or American university allowed to discuss delousing chamber technology? That is the main way of hygiene delousing before DDT was invented. Why is nobody allowed to discuss this? What is a taboo that it's forbidden?
Well, as I explained to Richie, in my view, I mean, there is no historical claim that should be sacrosanct and immune from investigation if the Holocaust was a reality, as I have been inclined to believe, but with certain qualifications in terms of its scope and exactly what took place, then surely scientific research is going to confirm it. And if it was not a reality, then surely we're entitled to know the truth, because it's been such a powerful influence on the actions that have been taken in the political arena. Kevin, I'd welcome your thoughts about this. I mean, is there any justification for laws such as they have in Germany that forbid the denial of the Holocaust? To me, that's simply absurd.
Well, it's worse than that. It's kind of suspicious. You know, I have never been convinced by arguments that the Holocaust was invented out of whole cloth, or that it was vastly smaller than we're told. But I do think, you know, I've understood from reading on the subject that a lot of claims about the Holocaust have been shown to be false. That when I grew up, we thought that the Nazis made lampshades out of the skin of their victims, and they extracted all their teeth and so on. And then that turns out not to be true. We were also told that the German camps were death camps, or a number of them were. And now the established wisdom in the Holocaust studies departments in the universities is that there were no death camps in Germany. There were only in Poland. And the official number of people killed at Auschwitz was reduced by close to 3 million people, I believe, from 4-something to 1-something million people. So there have been these pretty vast changes in the established wisdom on the Holocaust. And it seems pretty ridiculous, given that, to say that there are absolute limits that could never be transgressed, such as questioning gas chambers. Let's say that it turns out that it's true there were no killing gas chambers. That doesn't necessarily mean that millions of people didn't die in these camps. It just means maybe that they died in other ways. So we have to look at all of these issues fairly and objectively. And I think Nick is right that it's been turned into a religion, a false religion. Even, you know, I would call it a form of idolatry. And it's a terrible thing that's happened, because before World War II, most Jews around the world were anti-Zionist. They did not believe in the project of exterminating the Palestinian people to create a Jewish state in Palestine. And then because of the Holocaust story in World War II, the majority of the world's Jewish population, I believe, lost faith in God, lost faith in their religion, and went to this satanic, heretical faith of Zionism. And the underpinnings of Zionism is this notion that Jews were exterminated in gas chambers in the Holocaust, and that somehow irrationally excuses what's been done to the Palestinians. So that religious aspect of the Holocaust needs to be completely shredded and removed, and it needs to be put back into the field of history, so people like Nick Kallerstrom and everybody else who wants to do historical investigation can do it without fear of being socially ostracized or turned into a leper or thrown in prison.
Yeah, right. I mean, in schools in this country, it's the one and only subject that is taught both in history and in religion, okay? They get this Holocaust stuff all the time. If I may quote, just to endorse what Kevin said, can I quote some words he wrote?
Sure,
this is the founder of Amajka, right.
Of course.
He said, "You can tell which story is sacred and which one isn't by the reaction you get when you commit sacrilege. No one in the West is being brought up on charges of denying the crucifixion and resurrection. People can blithely doubt the crucifixion and the resurrection and the virgin birth and the Trinity and other tenets of Christianity and still work in the great universities of the West. In fact, if they don't doubt these things, they might have a harder time getting home. Admit at a faculty luncheon that you don't doubt the resurrection of the virgin birth, and you will get some very strange looks. But admit that you doubt any aspect of the sacred Holocaust narrative, 6 million Jewish victims, most killed in gas chambers, as part of a preconceived effort to eliminate Jewry from the face of the earth, and you will never work in this town again."
Isn't that astounding? Kevin, you wrote that. Wonderful.
And that is really the situation. He wrote it apropos of this bishop, Bishop Williamson, who suddenly he gave a figure of a bit under 300,000, the total number of Jews who died in the German labor camps. And he said that the big Sinai gas chambers had not existed. He quoted the Leuchter report. I mean, I think it's a wonderful, diamond clear words of truth. And suddenly he's not allowed to preach anywhere at all. And he suddenly removed to a little room in Wimbledon in South London, and he's a bishop, and he's not allowed to, totally banned by the Pope. The Pope instructs him, so it is. There is a new Inquisition. Heresy has come back, and this is an operating world religion. That's my opinion,
Kevin.
Oh, I think you're right. There's actually an Israeli professor, and I'm forgetting his name, but he's been extensively quoted by Gilad Atzmon, who has written about the Holocaust as a substitute religion that has taken the place of Judaism for a great number of the world's ethnic Jews. And I think that's true. And that religion has actually been pushed beyond the boundaries of Jewry to really become, I think, in a sense, the core religion of the West. I mean, the whole notion of the West was created as opposed to the East, and the East means the Islamic world. In those days, I guess China was so far east, they never thought of that. So this whole idea of creating a Western identity originally was an anti-Islamic identity. We're Westerners as opposed to Muslims. And today, the same thing has been extended and even made more rabid in some ways than it was at the time of the Crusades by using this Holocaust sacred story to justify the theft of Palestine, which has in turn created a new crusade against the Islamic world.
See, traditional religions had this vision of glory at the center of religion, like Muslims got a wonderful heaven with virgins giving them bowls of fruit and stuff. Hope I got that right.
I would say that's actually an image. In other words, you know, imagine the most beautiful and pleasurable scene you could possibly imagine on Earth, and paradise is even. That's what that means.
Right. Well, okay. And it's something you look forward to, okay? Well, the Holocaust is centered on this vision of ghastly horror. And people, this consoles people nowadays. I can say, well, okay, look, I feel bad. I'm depressed, but at least I'm not as bad as that. And it's the basis of modern nihilism and kind of post and 20th century kind of despair and unbelief and rejection of any concept of kind of, I would say, sort of proper sort of evolution or hope. The concept, the Nazis killed 6 million Jews for no reason. That's the crux of the matter. This Holocaust story, Nazis gassed 6 million Jews for no reason. And because there's no reason for it, it can be summoned up again any time. Like at the primary elections now, Newt Gingrich was just saying, oh, we're going to get another Holocaust unless we bomb Iran, you know. Unless we go for Iran, we risk having a second Holocaust. And it's continually invoked by politicians, and it can always be invoked because the initial event happened for no reason.
Indeed. And that's part of why it's a sacred myth rather than a historical narrative. A historical narrative wouldn't claim that something happened for no reason. It might admit that the reasons behind a particular event are so tangled up and there are so many reasons that we'll never know the exact chain of causality. But you don't take any historical event completely outside causality and hold it up as some kind of epitome of human evil. When you start doing that, you're creating a religious myth. And once people start mythologizing, then they stop paying attention to the facts, to cold, hard historical facts, and they start admitting anything that reinforces their historical myth. And I think that has happened with the Holocaust. I think it's very rational for people, especially for people in the Islamic and Arab worlds, to question the Western narrative of the Holocaust. Now, for many reasons, of course, one is that the winners always write history and always exaggerate their own goodness and the evil of their enemies. And so one would expect that the evils of the Germans would be exaggerated by the victors after World War II, given the horrors of the war. And then given the great lies of Zionism, one would expect that this kind of core proposition of Zionism, that somehow the Nazi Holocaust somehow justifies the extermination of the Palestinians, is so irrational that people who notice this naturally are going to be questioning whether this Holocaust story really happened as described. So I think it's not at all irrational or outrageous for people to question the story of the Holocaust. But I do think that people ought to not, you know, leap to the far extreme and start cheering for the Nazis. And, you know, I've heard these people who...
Well, we need a balance. That's the terribly difficult thing, that revisionism needs to be some sort of universal human endeavor. And what we have in common is that we don't believe in war. The Holocaust is a war-ratifying mythology. After Britain and America had dropped 2.5 million tons of bombs on Central Europe, incinerated all these old cities, it wanted to get the moral high ground, and it fabricated this story, that was the reason for it. It gives the concept of pure evil. You ask English people why was it done, and they would say because the Nazis were wicked. It was an expression of their wickedness. And this has the scary implication that if you yourself don't believe it, you become damned yourself. You suddenly get ethically damned. What you thought was, you might have thought was some permitted discussion, or you're looking at chemical evidence, how the Zyklon was used. Suddenly, you're being ethically damned because you have not sufficiently appreciated how wicked the Nazis were. So this image of pure evil is a kind of counterpole. Traditionally, religions gave you some image of good, what was ultimately good, and what we'd all strive for, whereas this new religion gives you what is ultimately evil, and the purpose of that ultimate evil is for politicians to be able to manipulate the masses in speeches and ratify new wars and so forth.
Well, I think you're right, Nick, overall. Now, I would argue, however, that what probably happened with the Holocaust story in the West is that there's a grain of truth to it. Well, there's a very large grain of truth to it. I don't think anybody, even the least sensible of the revisionists, would argue against the proposition that there was a tremendous amount of racism and ethnocentrism in the Nazi philosophy, that the Nazis did mistreat many minorities as handicapped people and others who were genetically, quote-unquote, unfit, and that these groups were rounded up and sent to work camps. And in some of these work camps, I understand the evidence is absolutely clear that people in very, very large numbers were worked to death, and that those who couldn't work were killed. That, I think there's lots of evidence for that. And when I did a couple of radio shows on this topic, I hosted debates between people on both sides of this question.
Yeah.
And the bottom line of it was that both sides, including my revisionist guest, Thomas Dalton, admitted that the Nazis kept very accurate records, that they did ship millions of Jews as well as gypsies and others to these camps, and that we have the records of millions going to these camps.
Well, hundreds and of thousands.
Well, he was conceding millions, I think.
The records are kept in the office, the Bad Arolsen archive in north of Germany, that has the records of everyone who lived and died in the German labor camps. And as far as I know, there are not records anywhere else. So if you want to talk about documents of how many people were in the camps, that, as far as I know, is the only place that keeps documents.
Okay, and so you're saying that those documents indicate hundreds of thousands.
Well, my research indicates there's three different occasions on which the Arolsen archives have come out with totals for about 13 or 15 different labor camps, how many in total have they had registered as being there and as dying. They have not done that at all in the 21st century because obviously German law prohibits denying the Holocaust, and that would include any undervaluing of the 6 million figure, okay? You'd get put in jail. So they're very reticent about coming out with the thing that we're most interested to hear from them, namely the total, okay? But I would say the total endorse what Bishop Williamson came out with recently as somewhat under 300,000 overall for people who lived and died in those camps. Now, there is another argument, which you find on Wikipedia, that there were loads and loads of other people in the camps who were not registered, just kind of milling around. And after all, if they were going to exterminate them anyway, why would they want to register them? That is a conjecture which you can make. But the documents, that is the number which the documents indicate.
Well, that's very interesting. Well, I didn't know that. In any case, there was obviously a lot of racism and ethnocentrism and brutal treatment of minorities, handicapped people, gypsies and Jews and so on in Nazi Germany. Yeah. And the Nazi government was obviously also extremely militaristic and illiberal, to say the least. In many ways, I think fascism was evil. You know, fascism, and we're getting some of that same fascism right now here in the USA firsthand. I can tell you that it's evil just from actually experiencing it today, post 9/11 in the USA. So I think there's a lot of truth to this idea that there was a lot, there was a certain kind of evil under Nazism and fascism, and how much that got exaggerated in this Holocaust story, we don't know. We know it got exaggerated because we know that there were initially all sorts of claims of lamp shades from human skin like that that turned out not to be true.
Let me agree with most of what you're saying, Kevin. Only I'd want to add that international Judaism did issue major declarations of war against Germany 1933 onwards, saying we want to crush this new regime, we want to destroy it. Jews all around the world have to collaborate in this economic stranglehold. And there was a massive boycott, especially from America, of German goods and trying to stifle German exports. And Germany is a country that cannot feed itself. It absolutely depends on exports. And this was having a dire effect. And the decision to put Jews into the labor camps, which I'm not defending, but I think it was a consequence of that struggle that was going on.
Nick, this is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, continuing my conversation with Nick Kohlerstrom from the UK and Kevin Barrett from Wisconsin. Nick, you were making the point about the way in which Germany was being precluded from access to material. Go on.
Yeah, I'd like to ask Kevin, would you agree that when Jews were rounded up in 1938, 39 and sent off to these labor camps, would you agree that what is translated as the final solution, Endlösung der Judenfrage, final solution of the Jewish question, that was an export program and they weren't quite sure where to export it to, whether that Jews to Madagascar or Israel, and there are different places they wondered, but they wanted to get them out of Germany. My understanding is that in all the documents examined so far, that never has a lethal meaning, that term. It always means export and doesn't mean extermination. I wonder if Kevin would grant that at all.
Well, I'm not sure about that, Nick. I know I've encountered some quotes from leading Nazis, and I don't have them right in front of me. It's been a while since I read about this issue that made it sound like words like this, uprooting, liquidation, and so on, were used in ways that you could interpret as being pretty ambivalent. And it definitely sounds like the Nazis wanted to get Jews out of the Nazi-occupied zone in Europe permanently. And whether that was just pure killing, whether that was a combination of killing and exporting, or just exporting, I'm not 100% sure based on my knowledge. I wouldn't say that one should be thrown in jail for their opinion about this question.
Yeah. Okay. Could I perhaps move on now to how I came into this study? Fascinates me about it?
Yeah.
Okay. I would advise, by way of entry into this highly explosive, controversial area, to say that people were not killed by cyanide gas in the German labor camps, and possibly not in the whole of World War II. I would recommend Americans especially to heed the testimony of Charles Larson. He was the top consultant pathologist of the US Army, and they sent him over to these, in 1945, they said, look, these German labor camps, Dachau, Auschwitz, Birkenau, there's huge piles of stiffs, go and find out what they died from. So he did, okay? And he said they died from typhus and famine, and they pressed him on this. They said, oh, well, hang on. What are these stories about the gas chambers? What about gas victims? And he wouldn't budge. He said, no, he had not seen victims of cyanide gassing. And let's be clear, the symptoms of that death are very distinctive because cyanide denies oxygen to the body and the whole skin goes a kind of pinkish red in the death throes. Okay. He said he had not seen any cyanide death evidence in the German labor camps.
And the corpse would retain that color.
The corpse would retain that color, yeah. I would say in general, apart from him, nobody whatsoever has ever seen or been shown any pile of alleged gas victim bodies.
Which would have had a pinkish or rosish tint to them.
Yeah, well, there's two main claims, you see. Two-thirds, traditionally, 4 million, were supposed to be gassed by cyanide, and the other one-third were supposed to be gassed by diesel exhaust. Diesel exhaust contains carbon monoxide, and it's alleged that some sort of lorries or something were tied up to some sort of chamber, and people put in the chamber, and the lorry and the engine blew diesel exhaust, and that killed them. So those are the two alleged methods of gassing, okay? Traditionally, Now, what happened in the 1980s, Fred Leuchter came along. He was sent by the terrific Zundel trial was going on in Toronto, Ernst Zundel. And Zundel had this bright idea. Him and the brilliant his brilliant lawyer, Forison, they got Leuchter, sent him over, told him where to sample, got his samples measured, and he came out with a sensational result, truly sensational result, which is really the beginning of modern revisionism, okay? He got them analysed, and he found 5,000 parts per million iron cyanide from the little delousing chambers, which everyone had forgotten about, okay? Back in this time, nobody knew of this delousing technology. It had been totally written out in the history books. Let's be clear that at the Nuremberg trial, merely presenting a can of Zyklon was evidence for the fiendish intent of the Nazis. It was as evidence for human gassing, a can of Zyklon. Okay,
its use for delousing was never even mentioned.
That was, I think, more or less totally obliterated from the Nuremberg trials. So it was alleged. I'll jump back now to 1946. Rudolf Höss, he was the commandant of Auschwitz up until 43, and he was seized by a British Army hit team and tortured for 3 days and three nights, and they finally got a confession out of him, or rather, they got him to sign an eight-page English confession, which he then signed as a German confession, and that signed confession by him was read out at Nuremberg, and that was said to be his account of what happened, and that he quote, confessed, unquote, to killing 3 million people in his camp. And the fantastic stories, for example, huge piles of burning corpses, they come from stories like this extracted under torture, okay? Fantastical stories. There'd be 2,000 people piled into this washroom or morgue, a long, thin room, and the Zyklon would be ushered in, then in 20 minutes, everybody's dead, okay? This is total fantasy, absolute physical impossibility, and it comes from somebody who's had his balls smashed in and been totally deprived of sleep, tortured, and told that his family are liable to be done in as well if he doesn't play the game.
Right. So I think the points you're making are extremely good. I've also gathered, by the way, that there may not have been more than 6 million Jews in all of Europe, and therefore the claim that there could have been 6 million who were, you know, killed during the Holocaust seems a bit far-fetched.
I've got a list of 200 quotes from 6 million Jews, starting from 1900 up to 1945. It's kind of mantra that keeps running through the 20th century. 6 million Jews, this, that, they're suffering, they're being exterminated, they're in danger, and newspaper headlines keep invoking 6 million. And it was a kind of figure for the total number of Jews in Europe, okay?
Yes.
And then in 1946, it suddenly becomes 6 million Jews are gassed. And that becomes the mantric, so the terrific mantric figure. And it's a bit of a mystery where it comes from. Nobody seems to know where the 6 million figure comes from. But
yeah, Nick, I know that 6 million seems to be a core figure for the dogma that sacred dogma of the Holocaust, that there were 6 million. So that if you deny it, the figure of 6 million, then you're automatically suspect.
Yeah, and can I give advice to anyone listening to this? If you want to have an intelligent, interesting discussion, just avoid this question of the total number. You will never get a good answer to it. I've never in my life heard of any group of people agreeing on an answer to this question. Just say, I don't know, and focus on what does really matter, and that is the question of how Zyklon was used in World War II. I think that's the really interesting, important issue. Was it used let me give a definition of Holocaust denial. A Holocaust denier is a person who believes that Zyklon was used in accord with the instructions on the tin, okay? If you believe that the Zyklon insecticide was used in the delousing chambers just as it's supposed to be used, if you believe that normal hygiene technology worked in ordinary, normal manner in the German labor camps, then that is what is meant by Holocaust denial, okay?
Yes.
To be a Holocaust believer, and it's interesting that this term is never used because it's kind of absurd kind of concept. Okay. To be a Holocaust believer, which all good, decent citizens have to be, you have to believe in something which never existed before World War II, never existed. Well, what I was saying, Kevin, I was venturing to give a definition of Holocaust denial. A Holocaust denier is a person who believes that Zyklon was used in accord with the instructions on the can. Okay.
Obviously, that's one specific version of Holocaust denier. Because if you challenge the 6 million figure, you're also a Holocaust denier.
Yeah, you are.
And if you suggest there were other causes of death for the massive piles of corpses we've all seen in the newsreel footage, you're also a Holocaust denier. So if you believe that they were, you know, the camps were abandoned by the German guards in the face of the Russian advance and they didn't want to be slaughtered by the Russians, that makes you a Holocaust denier too, if they actually died from starvation because the Germans were no longer able to provide them with food.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the thing about the concept, Holocaust denial, there's so much despair and horror in it that most people don't like to tackle the subject, okay? It tends to lose your friends and break up conversations and get you ethically damned. And I'm trying to suggest that a way to have an interesting conversation without giving everyone the screaming heebie-jeebies is to focus on the chemical evidence for how the Zyklon was used. We all know that many tons were used starting in 1942, and it's rather strange that the stories of all these gas Jews tend to start around the middle of the war, around the beginning of 1942, and that is when the BBC starts promoting the story, starts broadcasting the story of human gas chambers. Why would it start then, right in the middle of the war? It started then because that's when the actual gas chambers were being built, because that's when typhus epidemic struck the German labor camps. You got these delousing chambers constructed, people arriving in the camps had their clothes put into the gas chambers, not themselves. Okay, that's the essential difference.
Kevin, how toxic have you found the topic to be yourself?
Well, what's interesting was that when I became well-known in the 9/11 truth movement, suddenly I started getting libeled as a so-called Holocaust denier, even though I'd never discussed that topic, and I was charged with being a supporter of three leading Holocaust deniers, two of them I hadn't even heard of, and the third I knew, Irving. I knew very little about.
Irving. Yeah.
So that I found very interesting, that as soon as I, did work for 9/11 Truth, somebody just up Holocaust denier and gets it on Wikipedia and it won't come down. I found that to be a coincidence. So that gradually that kind of piqued my interest in the whole subject of the Holocaust. Why are they doing this? It took me several years to get around to doing a little reading on it. I'm still so far from an expert. I really don't have any firm opinion on any of these controversies, but my one firm opinion is that people should be free to investigate and discuss this and all other questions.
You mentioned Wikipedia. I've just discovered that my entry has been butchered. It's been cut in half, and one of those who's an editor there is a fellow named John McAdams, who is well known as a conspiracy denier, so that all of my discussion about the assassination of JFK was taken out. I protested and they put a few sentences back, but the whole thing is completely ridiculous. I mean, anyone who has any doubt that Wikipedia is some kind of disinformation op should be completely disillusioned here. I explained my experience with Wikipedia before in relation to 9/11. Where I have an article out there entitled Wikipedia is a 9/11 disinformation op, or Wikipedia as a 9/11 disinformation op. You can find it anywhere, where I was making corrections to the historical record about the history of scholars, and they were repeatedly being rejected. Every time I made them, Nick, an editor erased them. And now I find when I tried to redo even this abbreviated entry to make it more accurate and complete while verifying every claim I made, Wikipedia claims they want verification. So I was giving a citation, an objective verification for every single claim I made. Nevertheless, they reverted it to this completely atrophied version. I had noticed that when I would enter Jim Fetzer, it used to always go, the first listing would be my wiki page. And then perhaps a couple of weeks ago, I noticed now it was my curriculum vitae instead of the wiki page. And I expect that's when they changed it, that the wiki page was so uninformative, that they butchered it so badly that that people are finding my CV more valuable and instructive. But I think that the issue I want to raise with the two of you is actually this use of the claim of being anti-Semitic as a political club. It seems to me it's been used with devastating effect.
I think anybody who gets into this region gets the three synonyms hurled at them. The three synonyms are anti-Semite, Nazi, and Holocaust denier. And you just have to have some sort of purity of heart and let these bounce off you and affirm your own identity. That's all you can do.
Well, as I pointed out to Richie Allen, I've even published on this. I have an article entitled, Is 9/11 Research Anti-Semitic?, where we have to draw a distinction between what anti-Semitism amounts to, which is discounting or disvaluing an individual or their views because of their religious beliefs or their ethnic origins, whereas criticizing the actions, the policies of the government of Israel is not anti-Semitic even remotely. But where this has become a political club, in fact, the irony is that the fact of the matter is practically everyone in Israel immigrated to Israel. None of them are Semites in terms of the strict technical definition of what it is to be a Semite, which is a linguistic distinction. All of the Palestinians and the Arabs are Semites. So actually, the real anti-Semites in the world are those who protest against anti-Semitism, namely the Israelis themselves.
Oh, totally. It's a linguistic trickery. It's absolute language entrapment.
It's a perversion. Don't you find that fascinating, Kevin?
I mean, any reply, you shouldn't use the word Holocaust. I strongly advise not to use that in any reply.
Well, Kevin's quite a versatile linguist himself. You must find this quite fascinating, do you not, Kevin?
Well, it's interesting. You know, this goes back to the 19th century when the European scholars were imagining that people could be broken down into discrete races, and that these races...
Kevin.
Oh, no.
I think we lost Kevin again, so we'll get him back. See if we can get him back again. But...
Shall I continue in the meantime?
Yeah, please do. Here we are back with my two guests. I do not believe these interruptions in our Skype is merely coincidental. Kevin, we were talking about the distinction, the definition of what it is to be a Semite as a linguistic distinction that fits the Arab people, and in particular the Palestinians, where virtually no Israelis are actually Semitic because they've all immigrated from other lands, and where, therefore, the allegation of anti-Semitism is being made by people that are actually the greatest practitioners of anti-Semitism in the world.
Well, I don't think it's quite that simple, Jim, but pretty close. The notion that Jews were Semites came up in the 19th century when European scholars categorized people according to their linguistic branches and assumed that that was racial as well. So the fact that Jews had as their sacred language this Hebrew, which is a Semitic language, meant that they were labeled as Semites. It was believed that they came from the Middle East racially, which wasn't true. But this became the basis of European racial prejudice against Jews. And it's interesting that this is just one special case of European racial prejudice against non-Europeans, which has led to Holocausts and genocides all over the world. In any event, when the Zionist movement did bring a lot of Jewish immigrants back, to Palestine, they then resurrected Hebrew, which had been a sacred language, kind of like Latin, and they turned it into a modern spoken language. And so today, this is the national language of Israel, modern Hebrew, and it is a Semitic language. So in that sense, the linguistic sense, the Israeli Jews are actually Semites, but it's not an accurate racial category. It's actually Semitic languages are all over the Middle East, and people who are called Arabs actually are wildly disparate in terms of their genetic background, ranging from white, blonde, blue-eyed Berbers in the hills of Morocco to a different group of very white, blonde, blue-eyed people in Syria to black African people in parts of Morocco, Egypt, Libya, Sudan, and so on. It's a big mixture. But the way it's been simplified and the word Semitic has come to be used almost only when people are talking about prejudice against Jews, i.e. anti-Semitism, is kind of strange. And I guess it just goes to show you that these, you know, the evolution of racism is a very peculiar thing.
Of course, as you well know, those who are discussing evidence, objective evidence of Israeli complicity in 9/11, are thereby qualified as being anti-Semitic The ADL, as you well know, recently issued a statement about the anti-Semitic conspiracy theorists in which they targeted Gordon Duff, Alan Sabrowski, you, and me. And what I found ironic about that article, Kevin, was they were actually quoting from my piece, Is 9/11 Research Anti-Semitic?, where if you actually paid attention to the points I was making, it would be very clear that 9/11 research is not anti-Semitic.
Well, I think what's the real irony here is that after 9/11, the media whipped everyone into an anti-Arab, anti-Muslim frenzy by using stereotypes of Arabs and Muslims as vicious, violent hijackers who cut throats with sharp things like box cutters. Very, very racist kind of image. And it's directed against Semitic people, that is, Arabs. So there was this outburst of horrific, nearly genocidal anti-Semitism after 9/11, and it was directed, of course, against Arabs. And I think the people that's just a fact, because Jewish Americans are disproportionately represented in our media, and because of the religious fight over Palestine, the majority of Jewish Americans tend to be somewhat anti-Arab and anti-Muslim in their outlook, just as the majority of Arabs and Muslims tend to be somewhat anti-Jewish or anti-Zionist in their outlook. It's because these two groups are fighting over Palestine. So, of course, each group has negative ideas of the other group.
Yeah. And, Kevin, do you think this threatened war against Iran, is that in large degree because Iran has held a Holocaust conference, which allowed people to doubt it? I mean, hasn't Iran doubted the primary, what I call the two sacred myths of the New World Order? It's doubted the primary myth that created Israel, okay? The Holocaust is the myth that created Israel. Iran is casting doubt on that as an official position. And also, it's telling America to look within itself, its own military structure, about who did 9/11. So it's casting doubt on these two tremendous myths in the modern world. Is that a reason why it's now under threat of attack?
I think so, yes. I think there's a difference in the way that the Iranian leadership has treated these two issues. With the Holocaust, they've simply said that it needs to be debated, and they did host a conference. And most people don't realize that the so-called revisionist conference on the Holocaust in Tehran actually featured nearly 90% of the participants who did not really in the Western narrative of the Holocaust. Only about 10% directly did. The rest of them were discussing its meaning, the religious aspect of it, the relation between this Holocaust and other Holocausts of other allegedly non-Western people and things like that. So it was not a conference devoted to quote-unquote Holocaust denial. Far from it. It was a conference devoted to discussing various issues of the Holocaust, and they just allowed people who like you, who were skeptical about the facts of the Holocaust, to come to the conference. That's all they did. So it's just ridiculous that the Iranians have been slandered and shot at for this, when what they did was absolutely reasonable.
That's the only country in the world that could allow, had the guts to allow a discussion on the subject, isn't it? Anywhere else, it would be totally unthinkable.
Right. So their position is absolutely defensible on that.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, concluding my conversation with Nick Kullerstrom and Kevin Barrett. Gentlemen, I'm so glad to have you both here. I think this is simply terrific. The conference in Iran is fascinating. And, of course, Kevin, as you're well aware, there's an enormous amount of evidence of Israeli complicity in 9/11, including, of course, a book by marshaled together in a book by Christopher Bolin and many articles by Alan Sabrowski, websites such as Rediscover.
Hey, Jim, could I just come in a bit? This is our last session.
Yes.
Could I come in a bit on science aspects of
Oh, absolutely. Just let me finish this point, Nick, and you're welcome to do that.
Right. So
websites such as Rediscover 9/11 and, of course, the article that compiles a great deal of this evidence, Israel did 9/11, all the proof in the world. Nick, I just wanted to work that in so that people who think that maybe this idea that Israel was complicit in 9/11 are talking through their hat. There's no doubt about it. There's a great deal of evidence. Three different groups of Israelis were even apprehended in New York on 9/11, one of them near the George Washington Bridge with a van full of explosives. that I believe actually exploded. So we have police reports about it. But I do agree with you about wanting to pursue the scientific aspect, which, of course, has been your concern. Please do pursue that.
Rudolf Hess gave this confession at Nuremberg after torture, and that had hydrogen cyanide zyklon pellets being dropped in through holes in the roof of these long chambers. Now, to start with, first of all, he knew perfectly well there were no buildings anywhere in any German land bank camp with holes in the roof like that. His initial confession had it coming through sort of pipes in a bathroom, sort of watertight pipes that it suddenly had cyanide gas coming through. And then he changed it to holes in the roof. And then there were, next thing he knew, there were long columns coming down through which these imaginary columns through which the pellets were dropped. Okay. And you had then have everyone dead, 2,000 people dead in 20 minutes. And because of the slow release of Zyklon and the rate at which, without any heating or without any fans, the rate at which the Zyklon will release the hydrogen cyanide, that is a complete impossibility. Okay. So that's the first thing I'd like to say, that what he came out with under torture, that has to be the basis of all post-war accounts of the Holocaust, of the millions of people gassed by cyanide, because Hoss is the source. There is really no other source than Hoss, and everyone has to agree with him. All modern books have to endorse his absolutely mad concept of everyone dead in 20 minutes. And then what happens? Oh, the Nazis go in, pull the bodies out. They don't even have gas masks. It happens in the actual rooms. There are only very small little doors, doors that open inwards, and you couldn't possibly pull out a tangled mess of massive stiffs. All of these accounts would instantly kill the guards doing it. So it's characterized by absolute physical impossibility. Let me stress that. Okay, so in 1988, Fred Leuchter comes along, and he takes these samples, and he shows this terrific 2,000-fold differential, 5,000 parts per million of iron cyanide. Total cyanide in the walls is measured by this Alpha Laboratories chemistry lab, 5,000 parts per million in the delousing chambers. These delousing chambers have blue walls after the war, lovely blue colour, because that is the colour of iron cyanide, totally saturated. Okay. Fred Leuchter then took samples from what are alleged to be human gas chambers. This is the all-important concept. There's absolutely nothing in any German lab camp that resembles a human gas chamber, whatever you think that looks like. But the big holo textbooks have said this is where it happened. This is where the sacred horror took place. This is where millions of people were gassed. So Fred Leuchter chipped out bits of walls from there, and lo and behold, he got absolutely no significant elevation above the normal control background level of the kitchens and dormitories and so on. Now, let me make clear that there is a human gas chamber post-war constructed by Stalin in 1946, which 30 million people are said to have trooped through, and tourists all get their tingle of terror, and compulsory school visits to Auschwitz all go through this gas chamber. And obviously, the German guys there are not allowed to tell you that, this is post-war constructed. But that post-war construction has got some original brickwork of what was there in the 1940s. Obviously, revisionists say, well, this is basically just a washroom, converted to an air raid shelter. But the big holo textbooks say this is where gassing took place. So Fred Leuchter took samples from there and he got no significant elevation. Okay. So Germar Rudolf then comes along. He's a brilliant chemist at the Max Planck Institute. And he reads the Leuchter report, this trailblazing Leuchter report that's been translated all different languages around the world. And by the way, Fred Leuchter is America's top expert on cyanide gassing. Mr. Death is called. He wanted to make cyanide gassing in the for death sentence in America as efficient as possible, take the pain out of it, you know. And so he's an expert, and his report, therefore, is so terse and compelling. He said there are no buildings here that could possibly have functioned as human gas chambers, even if you wanted them to. No way. They're just not airtight. They're not sealed. The doors aren't any good. They've got big water drains in the middle of the floor and ordinary glass windows. Everything is wrong about them.
You're saying all the scientific evidence contradicts the claims that have been made for the use of Zyklon B in gas chambers.
Yeah, yeah. And then Germar Rudolf comes along, and he does some very thorough sampling, Likewise in the 1980s. So there are two chemical studies using the similar method. And what I did, I combined these two together, these two different data sets, wall sampling, measuring total cyanide, and you got about 40 measurable cyanide levels taken from all different places. And that is quite a good data set. I think you can do good science on that and really show what's going on. I think it's totally conclusive. More research is not needed. And it clearly shows what I would say the basic definition of Holocaust denial. Holocaust denial is a person who believes that normal hygiene technology works in an ordinary, normal manner in the German labor camps. In other words, that Zyklon was used as it was meant to be used in the small little delousing chambers. There are only 10 cubic feet, 10 cubic meters in volume. These manufactured by the firm called Degesch, right? These delousing chambers, absolutely normal hygiene technology from the 1920s onwards. They have the high cyanide levels in the walls. They were designed for using with Zyklon. And what are alleged to be human gas chambers, that is just the nightmare hallucination dreamed up at Nuremberg by British American military intelligence. And let's consign it into the past history. Let's just leave it in the museum of yesterday's superstitions. It has no substance whatsoever. It's just a pipe dream.
Kevin.
Okay, well, that's a very interesting interpretation, and I hope to keep learning more about this topic and find out whether it's true, and I hope it's true. And it would be a wonderful thing if we could prove definitively to the world that this story was wildly exaggerated, because that could put an end to what's been a very, very destructive religious myth, this fundamentalist faith in the horrible evils of Auschwitz and the Nazis. That myth has turned into a myth supporting the goodness of Western violence against the world in general, and Palestinians, Arabs, and Muslims in particular. So, yeah. Well, I do hope you're right. At this point, I don't have enough information to know for sure. But
if I could add to agreeing with what Kevin said earlier, surely we can all agree that what the Jews went through in World War II, they call the Shoah, is the biggest trauma in their collective history. Nobody's trying to undervalue this, but they simply were not put into mass gas chambers. And as regards the other part of the story, the diesel gas chambers, various science experts have pointed out that diesel gas fumes would only have had a fraction of 1% of carbon monoxide, and there's absolutely no way it could be lethal. It simply cannot be a lethal gas. This emerged in the 1980s, when people were put in jail in Germany. You know, any expert speaking out gets put in jail. The diesel gas would have given everyone a nasty headache, but it's totally impossible that it could have killed anyone. That is just physically, the carbon monoxide is a lethal component, and there's just too little there. So that's the other side of the gassing story that likewise is a total pipe dream.
Kevin.
Okay, well, thank you. I urge you to write a book about this. Do the best book you can, nice, concise, and irrefutable, and help the world.
All right. Okay.
Well, I think we might want to do an article, Nick, for Veterans Today, in which you summarize the scientific findings. That would seem to me to be highly desirable.
Well, I got so vilified and damned by everyone after I came out with this in 2008, and especially what was most hurtful within the 9/11 Truth Movement. They kind of chucked me out, and they wouldn't hear about it, and they would just go on and on about very peripheral things, like the swimming pool, you know. Oh, he says there's a swimming pool at Auschwitz, as if this is proof that you're crazy. The important thing, which is this, the chemical evidence for the functioning of Zyklon, that is the central issue, I believe. And I believe that the central problem in America and Britain comes from the timidity of science historians who are not doing their job. I think if British universities or American taught about the way Zyklon was used in delousing chambers, I think that the hollow hoax narrative, the nightmare phantom hallucination of these mass gassings, would fade away of its own accord.
Well, and you know, Nick, that we've made this an issue with the History of Science Society because of the absurd and irresponsible review in ISIS of the book, the Biographical Encyclopedia of Astronomers. Is just shocking to me that there's been this lack of response, this dereliction of duty, this abdication of professional responsibility by this society, to me, is utterly stunning. Kevin, I believe, is unaware of all of this, but Nick was a contributor to a massive project, Kevin, published by an international publisher, the Biographical Encyclopedia of Astronomers. He wrote three entries, one of which was probably the most important in the entire encyclopedia, on Sir Isaac Newton. And nevertheless, when it was reviewed in ISIS, which is the Journal of the History of Science Society, by a fellow named Swerdlow from the University of Chicago, he lambasted the encyclopedia, not for any contents in the encyclopedia, not for the quality of the work, not even for Nick's entries, including his entry on Newton, but because Nick had done this research on the possible use of cyanide in during the Holocaust. And for that, he said the book should be sent back to its publishers, even by libraries, and pulped.
Leo, it's this kind of reaction that really makes you wonder whether they have something to hide. It sure sounds like they're protesting too much. You know, that kind of extreme overreaction, that kind of hysteria, is really a sign that I don't think they believe their own story. I'm not saying, you know, I don't know what's true or what's not true, but I think that that kind of hysterical overreaction to Nick's work is a symptom of people who deep down inside actually share his doubts.
So get this, get this, Kevin. So we wrote to the editor of ISIS complaining about this, and he allowed for there to be a letter of response, which I authored, but nothing more. And they certainly made no correction or reprimand of Swerdlow. And eventually Nick and I wrote to the editorial board. Actually, I wrote the letter to the editorial board of ISIS, actually, and to the board of directors of the History of Science Society. And would you believe they have not even responded to us?
I would believe it.
Isn't that stunning?
Well, this fundamentalist faith in the received version of the Holocaust is a central myth of Western culture. It's a sacred myth.
Bloody hell, a sacred myth, How did we get there?
Challenge it at your own risk.
How did we get there? Right. But if we just finish off talking about these Arrelson archives, if I may.
Oh, go ahead.
This has been the center for the last 50 years of all data, all claims of Holocaust survivors. So they've got all the documents there, and there are not documents anywhere else. People need to understand there are no documents in Jerusalem, not in Berlin, not in The Hague, not in London, not in Washington. There are no Holocaust documents, no documents verifying the Holocaust happened, no documents indicating any plan to construct human gas chambers, no documents indicating any intention to exterminate a specific race or ethnic group. The documents that do exist are at the Arrelson Archive. Okay. Now, on three occasions, 1970s, 80s, 90s, they have come out with this very, very dangerous thing, which we all want to hear more than anything else, was the total number of people who lived and died in German and labor camps, of which they have records. Okay, so those three estimates hover around a bit under 300,000. Those are the total, 270,000, 290,000, and about 60,000 at Auschwitz. That's the most famous and sort of interesting camp. That is a total number of deaths. They have not come out with any statement in the 21st century because, obviously, they'd just be arrested, okay? German law prohibits it. But what they have come out with in 2004 was a statement: they have no evidence whatever of any death by cyanide gassing. They have not one single record of death by cyanide gassing. So that is the data source. And by the way, all of the data at Arrelson is being copied into Washington. There's some big Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington that will have a total copy. And possibly anyone in America might want to try asking the people who get this total copy what the total is, because you're not put in jail in America if you answer that question, okay? It's not a crime to deny the Holocaust in America. So it's just possible that, in theory, that people who get all the archives in Washington can answer that question. Well, I'll tell you what, I feel there's a turning of the tide, Jim. I feel that people are getting fed up with all this propaganda, and especially in England. I think America, you're more intensively brainwashed with Holocaust stuff than we are. But in England, I notice whenever there's a news statement in the newspapers, what's interesting is, do they allow comments on blogs underneath the report? And if they do, I find that the comments tend to have a majority sceptical of the Holocaust narrative. Now, that's the only place where you get a real sense of what the national opinion is, because people are free to comment because they don't have to use their real name. And I think there's a turning of the tide now. I think people are sick and tired of this bogus, totally, incredibly bogus Holocaust stories.
I wonder if your standing in relation to your work on the Holocaust has not been bolstered by your very serious research on 7/7, Nick. I mean, going into a third edition, being featured on Richard Hall's television show, producing, you know, Kullerstrom and Farrell Are Dead, which is simply brilliant. I don't know if Kevin's seen it yet. I just think you're doing this fantastic work, and the British people must realize you care about the truth.
Well, let's hope that. It tends to feel the other way around, that whatever I do in life, people say, oh, but he denies the Holocaust. And that's a totally final comment. It doesn't mean they want to hear about the subject at all. It's an ethical damnation. That's the weird thing. It's as if people have got padlocked minds, and they will just come out with this ethical damnation that terminates discussion. It's so strange.
Kevin, would you like to add some reflections in the final minutes we have together?
I think that people are beginning to question these kinds of stories more and more, and especially because we can get not only get information through the alternative channels in our own alternative media, and the 9/11 Truth Movement in particular has helped build a robust, truly alternative media here in the USA, but we also have access to networks like Press TV out of Iran and Russia Today out of Russia. So the media environment is much larger and harder to censor now, and I think more and more people are sort of wandering beyond the confines of Fox News and BBC and looking at places that report things that they hadn't heard before and opening their minds. So in the long run, I do have hope that truth will prevail, assuming the bad guys don't manage to put chips in our heads first.
Which seems to be a non-trivial possibility from everything I hear.
Maybe so. I hope not. In any case, I do hope that Nick publishes more about his research. And as I told you, Nick, I would be happy to write a foreword to...
Oh, well, that'd be awesome, Kevin. Yeah, let's see what we can do there. Right.
Yeah, because even though at this point I'm not endorsing your conclusions, I'm certainly endorsing your freedom to do these experiments and to think about this very important issue.
Nick, why don't you give us a summing up? You're the guy who's been on the hot seat and all this. I'd really like for you to give us kind of an overall summary as we wrap today.
Poor. Okay. Well, revisionism means trying to look at both sides in a war. You don't just want to load all the evil onto one side, which is Germany in this case. Britain declared war on Germany twice in the 20th century. Neither time did Germany have any wish for war against England. After the First World War, all the black propaganda that to make the troops fight was shown to be fabricated, and they didn't want that to happen in the Second World War. So at the end of the war, they gave a transcendent meaning to this British war propaganda of fiendish Nazi gassing, and it became elevated to a status where nobody's allowed to doubt it, and it's a kind of driving force of our whole culture and civilization, and this is horrific, and I urge people to try and get together in groups and discuss this issue of what we're thinking in a post-Iraq context. You see, the Iraq war, when we discovered we'd been absolutely lied to about going to war, Britain and America, absolute pack of lies, I think that shook us up. And before then, we could hardly believe that the Nuremberg Tribunal was anything other than a great exercise in post-war justice. That's what I grew up believing. That's what we all believed. But I think after the Iraq war, we're capable of believing that the British and American military can actually fabricate this titanic, awesome lie.
Very nice, Nick. I'll just conclude by saying, if the Holocaust is real, then no one should have any reservations about it being debated, discussed, and investigated scientifically, because assuming the research is conducted responsibly, it will verify or confirm the reality of the Holocaust. And if the Holocaust was not real, if it has been grossly exaggerated, if, for example, cyanide was not used in gas chambers at any of the places as alleged, if this has become an enormous political myth that's been used to promote and drive a Zionist agenda, then it needs to be exposed and destroyed for the sake of the truth and justice for the people of the world. And that includes everyone, Jewish, German, whatever, on all sides. I want to thank you both.
Amen. Amen.
For being here, Nick. I want to thank you for being here, and Kevin, too, and all my listeners.
Yesterday, all my troubles seemed so far away. Now it looks as though they're here to stay. Oh, I believe in yesterday. Suddenly, I'm not half the man I used to be. There's a shadow hanging over me. Oh, yesterday came suddenly. Why she had to go, I don't know, she wouldn't say. I said something wrong, now I long for yesterday. Yesterday, love was such an easy game to play. I need a place to hide away. Oh, I believe in yesterday. Why she had to go, I don't know, she wouldn't say. I said something wrong, now I long for yesterday. Yesterday, love was such an easy game to play. I need a place to hide away. Oh, I believe in yesterday.